Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Reunification with biological parents has been the main objective of Ohio Child Protection agencies for many years. The emphasis has been on protecting parental rights, but children are dying. A months-long investigation by the Dayton Daily News found that since 2009, more than half of the 474 children who died from suspected abuse or neglect had been known to a protection agency. Coming up, we'll hear from children's services professionals and also a critic of the current system. Joining us now by phone is data journalist and investigative reporter for the Dayton Daily News, Katie Weddle. Welcome to the show, Katie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What does the reunification law have to do with these deaths, by and large?
Well, basically, both federal and state law really put reunification as the end goal of children's services cases. And that's just been a practice of judges and caseworkers for a long time that, you know, their goal is not to remove kids and never give them back to their parents. It's to help those families to get to a place where they can regain custody. So that's what they push in terms of training for their caseworkers. And that's sort of what judges always have in the back of their mind is getting that family back together.
Given that that's the ultimate goal, what do we know about the oversight when a child is returned to a formerly abusive parents?
Well, you know, it really varies is what I found out. A judge or a magistrate who grants custody back to biological parents basically makes a decision of how long is Children's Services going to remain involved with that family. It could be 3 months, it could be 6 months, it could be a year, you know, where they're checking up on the family. But it didn't seem in the cases that I investigated where a child died that there was very intensive scrutiny after the point of reunification.
I know that parents have to go through some training, dot some I's and cross some T's, but what kind of real support is out there for them once they take the children back?
I think that is an issue that needs to be addressed. It doesn't seem like, you know, there's usually continuing sort of social services if they're getting help, you know, in some way with mental health or with paying bills. But it didn't seem like there was a lot of intensive help for them in sort of getting back into their daily routine with their kids. And I know that that was something that foster parents that I talked to, you know, really felt like the parents that were getting their kids back weren't ready for. There was one case where the woman was getting all four of her kids back at once. And the foster parents who had been raising those kids were very concerned about her preparedness to take on four kids.
Were their concerns taken into consideration?
The foster parents I talked to said they didn't feel like they were heard. They are allowed to be in court. They are, you know, in communication with caseworkers. It just seems like it's a case-by-case basis of how much does the magistrate actually hear of those concerns and how much do they take that into account.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about child protection in the state of Ohio. My guest, Katie Weddle, is a data journalist and member of the Dayton Daily News I-team. She's worked for months on a story about the safety of children who are returned to homes where they have been previously abused. 474 Ohio children died at the hands of adults who were known abusers between 2009 and 2016, according to their investigation. Tell us about some. You've highlighted 19 of those cases for the purposes of your investigation. Why those 19, Katie?
Well, basically, this started with the data, and the data showed that those were there was probably about 25 cases that came up where it appeared that the children had been removed from Children's Services. There had been a bad enough situation where they had actually been removed, put into foster care or with a relative, and then they had been put back with the biological parents before they died. And so I looked into those cases. Some of them ended up, you know, the situations didn't quite fit that narrative. There were other circumstances involved, but I boiled it down to those 19 that, you know, really stood out as cases where, you know, there was questions about why that child was put back into that home and whether there was proper oversight when that happened.
Were there any common denominators that led you to any conclusions about what went wrong?
You know, not really. I mean, I expected to see maybe there was domestic violence charges or something to that effect. These were all, and the Children's Services folks will tell you, you know, every case is different mm-hmm. and every family's circumstances are different. There are programs in which counties are trying to look at data and find some common denominators and red flags. Because I didn't have the full children's services records for these cases, I'm not sure. Maybe there are some common things that they can find if they look at the data.
Why don't you get access to the full records?
In Ohio, they are completely confidential. Even after a child's death, some counties are willing at the point of a tragedy like a death happening to release some information, but most of the counties that I dealt with still keep everything confidential and won't even really talk about specific cases.
Even when there's been a crime committed?
Yeah, I mean, you can get, if there's a criminal case, I was able to get criminal court records mm-hmm. that, had a lot of details about it, but still was not able to get children's services records.
Just over half of Ohio's 88 counties maintain a property tax levy that supports children's services. How does that play out in an agency's efforts to protect a child, to support families once the child returns to the biological parents?
Well, funding is just so critical in this because it pays for caseworkers. It pays for their time to really devote to these cases. And when speaking with Attorney General Mike DeWine, he said about the counties that don't have those levies, he said, I don't know how they get the job done because mm-hmm. they're relying on their county commissioners to give them funding. And we know every county is strapped and has so many other obligations that they need to with that money. So
with these 19 kids that you focused on, did they tend to come from poorer counties?
They were all over the map. There were rural counties. There were numbers wise, there were more of them in the larger urban counties, but that's obviously because there's more
right.
children and families there. We had rural counties, Logan County, Montgomery County, Hamilton County, really was across the board.
Was poverty a typical factor or not? Were there socioeconomic all over the board too?
I don't know, I didn't necessarily know what parents did for a living or what their economic situation was. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like they were all, extreme poverty cases. And that's something I know you're going to have Richard Wexler on later. He might be able to talk about a little bit of sometimes there's a conflating of poverty with neglect of mm-hmm. if a family is poor. Oh, they must be there. Their kids don't have what they need. And if a family is rich, oh, they can't possibly be abusing their kids. And we know that that's not true because we've seen, abuse cases across the board.
The investigation found that Ohio fails to meet national standards on several key child safety measurements. What's relevant there?
Basically, these are measurements that everybody tries to use to, see if kids are being kept safe. One of them is, whether or not kids are re-abused after a certain amount of time. If there's an allegation or a substantiated case, if within a year there's another, that's a bad sign. And that was one that Ohio fell below other states. And others are, whether they have to re-enter foster care. How many times are they going back and forth between foster care and their parents? Obviously something is wrong there. So those were measures that we did not do well on. And then obviously the funding. Ohio is dead last in the nation in terms of how much state funding goes to counties.
About 10%, because like we said, right?
Yeah, because like we said, we basically make the counties figure it out for themselves.
Is there any activity in the Ohio General Assembly to address this issue?
I spoke with some lawmakers who are very concerned about this issue, but I think that right now they feel like they don't have a good answer to put something forward in a bill. They want to, get some more information and do some more looking into this to figure out, okay, what do we do to fix this?
Well, in 2011, Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine launched an overhaul of Ohio's child welfare system. What was his goal then? And it was described as an exhaustive overhaul.
Yeah, he came out, that was in the wake of the DeMarcus Jackson case, which is one that I profiled, this little boy who was put back with his parents and within 2 months was beaten to death by his father. And DeWine, really took this to heart and said, this cannot happen. We need to look at why this is happening. He went all around the state meeting with folks, having town halls about child welfare, and then a panel got together and made a list of recommendations Unfortunately, you know, with sometimes how these things turn out, only, you know, a handful of those recommendations ended up getting into a bill that was passed and did some good things, but just didn't really seem to go far enough to actually abate these deaths.
What did they do? I mean, can you give us some examples of what did get through in the legislation?
I believe in that piece of legislation, there was a piece about increasing training for guardian ad litems and CASA volunteers, who are basically child advocates in the courtroom. There were some pieces that didn't really have much to do with child safety. There was a piece about letting foster kids do normal things like go to sleepovers at a friend's house. That's a great thing, but it didn't really, you know, address the issue of child safety and abuse and neglect.
Well, did Attorney General Mike DeWine tell you why they couldn't get more pushed through?
He didn't. He just said, you know, that all the recommendations didn't get taken up. You know, a lawmaker has to kind of jump on that and put it together in a bill. And the pieces that they did get through were good and were progress, but the sort of meatier issue didn't get addressed.
Besides the issue of funding, which where Ohio ranks dead last in the nation, as far as those national standards go, what are some of the things that those national standards call for that Ohio's failing at?
It just basically calls for children to be more stable situations, to not re-enter foster care within a year of coming out of foster care, to not be re-abused within a year of having an abuse allegation, placement. There's different placement standards of sort of how many months or years before a child sort of gets a permanent placement. So unfortunately, it kind of feeds into the idea of reunification must be, you know, a goal within 2 years. That's what I've heard from folks who work in the system, is there's kind of this deadline mentality. At 10 months out of being out of, you know, a home, there's sort of this clock goes off of, oh, we have to start getting them moved towards reunification.
In one case, the child was returned when she was, I think, 4 years old, and was beaten to death by her mother, I believe. I was wondering what the age ranges are of these kids. Do they tend to be very young, toddlers, that kind of thing, who can't speak for themselves?
Yeah, I mean, most of the ones that I looked at, I think there was only one that was a teenager. Most were young, even younger than, four was actually on the high end. They were 1-year-old, 2-year-old. It seemed to be a lot of 2-year-olds, and I think that is sort of because of that. Sort of 2-year, 1 to 2-year cutoff of getting them back with their parents.
So they're taken away as infants and then returned as 2-year-olds.
And then returned as, 18 months.
It's also a tough time with a kid. If you've raised one, you know, I mean, it's the age.
Right. And if the parents aren't prepared to deal with a toddler temper tantrum, that's sort of where some of these situations arise.
We are going to continue our conversation. My guest is Katie Waddell. She's an investigative journalist for the Dayton Daily News. They wrote a series on the safety of children who are returned to homes where they have been previously abused. Their work found that 474 Ohio children died at the hands of adults who were known abusers between 2009 and 2016. Many of them probably didn't have to die, but the way the rules work nowadays with reunification being a pressing need, they were sent back. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the safety of children who are returned to homes where they have been previously abused. 474 Ohio children died at the hands of adults who were known abusers between 2009 and 2016. That's according to a recently published investigation by the Dayton Daily News. Still with us by phone is Dayton Daily News investigative reporter Katie Waddell. Katie, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Joining us now is the intake director at Franklin County Children's Services, Lara LaRoche. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Also with us, executive director of Public Children's Services Association of Ohio, Angela Saucer. Welcome.
Thank you.
According to the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio, the state's share of funding for county agencies has consistently ranked dead last in the nation. What's the problem?
We rank dead last in the nation when it comes to state funding. So the responsibility really rests on our counties to fund children's services. Over half of child welfare expenditures are paid by our counties. They are able to pull down about 38% in federal funds, and then the remaining funding is at 10% for the state. We are a state-supervised, state-administered state. The responsibility of administering children's services and really funding children's services falls on our counties.
What do other states do?
Other states, obviously, since we're dead last, they put a lot more money into children's services. For states that are state-supervised, state-administered, I mean, the responsibility is completely on the state to fund children's services They being able to draw down federal funding. For states similar to Ohio, those states invest a lot more money into children's services, and they take that burden off of counties.
Is it reflective, this number of children who have died since 2009? Is that reflective? Is there a correlation, at least, between the funding at the state level and what we're seeing as far as outcomes?
Obviously, if we had more state funding, we could have more caseworkers, we could spend more time with families, we could go out and be able to access more services to support families, we'd be able to recruit more foster families. I mean, we're really in a crisis here.
Yeah. I think it was John Husted said in the report that you did, Katie Waddell, that we need to recruit more foster families. Is it that simple?
Yeah, I mean, that's been the cry from several folks in state office. Mike DeWine had a press conference a couple months ago where he called on foster families to step up because of the opioid crisis, that there's really, a lot more children in need of at least temporary homes so that their parents can get clean and get them back. I don't know if that's the end all be all of the solution, but it's obviously a piece of it.
Lara LaRoche, the opioid crisis, that's playing a big role in all of this. I don't know if it has anything to do with these deaths, but as far as the burden on the agency, it's a big deal, right?
The opioid crisis is having a significant impact across Ohio. It certainly is a risk factor when it comes to a parent's capacity to keep their children safe.
We're talking about funding. Ohio ranks dead last among the states for state funding. Franklin County does have a tax levy to support children's services. Can you tell us about how much money we're talking about and whether it's enough? Particularly, obviously, it's a big county. It's a wealthier county, but it also has a lot more problems.
Franklin County actually has two tax levies that run every 5 years. And we're very fortunate that Franklin County has been very supportive of the children in the county and supporting the work that we do. One thing that we've definitely learned about families is we really have to understand their story to understand the risk factors that contributes to safety. We know that family engagement benefits from the time that we're able to spend with them. So it really becomes important that caseworkers have the time to be in the family homes, getting to know the families trusting them, so that we can work together cooperatively to make sure that children are safe throughout the county.
What's the equation for caseworkers in Franklin County? I guess that's all you can really speak to, but what's their caseload like? What's a day for them?
I would say that it's very dependent on the tenure of the caseworker.
How experienced they are.
Right. So attrition in child welfare across the country is a significant issue that all child welfare systems find themselves challenged with.
The burnout problem.
Right. So within our system, caseworkers have anywhere between 12 and upwards of 18 families that they're working with at any given time.
What do we mean by getting to know the family? Because there's probably an automatic sense of distrust of the caseworker.
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, I think that's true. And I think we always have to keep in mind that we're not always a welcome visitor. The perception of child welfare is often one that feels very threatening to a family. But at the same time, we have the obligation to assess child safety and to assess risk within the home. And so it's imperative that we're able to effectively engage the family to understand their story. And automatically, we know that there's going to be resistance on the other end, which isn't necessarily a bad thing for a family. That's a protective factor that a family should have to keep their children safe. And so there's this great balance and challenge between the perception of child welfare to families that have child welfare involvement and the responsibility of us to work with them and really understand what's going on with them and what they need in order to keep their children safe.
Angela Saucer, there is a lot going on in Franklin County. It's not only a wealthier county, it just has a lot of different kinds of programs for children and families. There's a paucity of those kind of programs in a lot of counties, though. How do they operate, say, in like a Pike County or, you know, one of the more remote counties, Brown, or anything like that?
So, obviously, we have every county has a children's services agency. Katie reported this in her articles that 47 of our counties are fortunate enough to have a children's services levy. We actually have 11 agencies today on the ballot across the state, either renewing or replacing levies.
Timely note.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, you know, those counties that aren't fortunate enough to have a children's services levy, they do rely completely on county commissioners and being able to access some county revenue funds. But, you know, children's services is just one component of the child welfare system.
Right.
And we rely on our partners, the mental health agencies, the developmental disability agencies, treatment professionals, particularly in light of the opioid epidemic, we really rely on addiction professionals, the judge, guardian ad litem, who are advocates for kids. I mean, it's really relying on other agencies to join us in protecting kids and preventing future fatalities or future abuse. So in counties that are more rural, that are poorer, that don't have as many resources, it's more challenging for our county agencies. I mean, there's not enough mental health professionals. There's not enough addiction treatment counselors. Families often have to go on a wait list to be able to access those services, which delays our progress with that family.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about wait lists when it comes to the life of a child, it's kind of academic at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. We are given by federal and state law 12 months to work on reunifying.
What's the magic of 12 months?
The magic is within 12 months. Our state law believes that a family should have completed their case plan. They should have met all their goals, meaning that they've gone through mental health treatment or addiction treatment. They've successfully recovered from their addiction. They've gone through parenting classes. And now they have enough safety measures in place to have a child return back home. Which is something we do strive to do, and we do meet that measure, a federal measure of children being able to return home within 12 months. However, if there's a wait list, that further complicates the situation. If a parent has to wait 6 months to get into addiction, well, you've just lost 6 months out of the 12 months. And so that family is almost set up for failure.
Right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about we're inspired to talk about these child welfare issues because of work done by Katie Waddell. She is an investigative journalist for the Dayton Daily News. They've reported that 474 Ohio children died at the hands of adults who were known abusers between 2009 and 2016. We're talking about the safety of children who are returned to homes where they have been previously abused. Still with us by phone, Katie Waddell, the journalist for the Dayton Daily News. Also, you just heard Angela Saucer. She's the executive director of Public Children's Services Association of Ohio. And also with us is Laura LaRoche. She's intake director at Franklin County Children's Services. If you have a question or a comment regarding this issue, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I wanted to go back to – I talked with Katie Waddell earlier about the 2011 overhaul of Ohio's child welfare system, which turned out to be not much of an overhaul. It turned out to be a little tweaking here and there, and then doing things like letting foster kids do normal things, which I've had shows about that issue as well. But it seems sort of beside the fact when it comes to children who are returned to homes where they're still being abused. What do you get out of that overhaul, I guess, Laura LaRoche? Do you remember that, and did it make any difference in the work you do?
I think that historically you can look at child welfare and see a number of reforms that are constantly in the making. And I think that what's very difficult about any behavioral science or any social science is that human behavior is incredibly unpredictable and family systems are dynamic. And so predicting what will happen next month or the month after really is quite the challenge within our system. We know that years ago, the child welfare system felt like the solution was to remove children from their families. And you saw many children institutionalized and being raised by the system or by government.
Because there weren't enough people adopting them and that kind of a thing.
I think partly, yes. But I think also it was the philosophy that the system could protect children from their family. I know that what we've learned over time is that systems can't effectively raise children and have good outcomes. And so there became a shift in child welfare where our position is not that we protect children from, but that we engage the family and help the family in their system to keep their children safe. Children should be raised in a family environment, not by an institution. And so you saw this evolution in child welfare to work with the whole family system. And that continues to be the direction, and I think it's the right direction. But I think that, again, the great challenge is understanding that family system, what the risk factors are within the system, and how you impact change and sustain change over time in a very dynamic environment.
How does poverty play a role in this?
Poverty obviously is a risk factor. If families aren't able to keep utilities on, if they're not able to have enough supports in their life, many of us rely on neighbors and friends and colleagues to raise the kids together. Those in poverty often suffer alone. They don't have many allies to reach out to rely on. And so that obviously threatens the child's safety.
It's not just a poverty in the bank account. It's a poverty of relationships and
right,
support
absolutely.
System that a lot of us take for granted. I'm just wondering, once a child is abused, traumatized sometimes by abuse, how do you follow up with them to make sure that they're getting better, that they're recovering from that trauma, even if there might have been physical abuse, but there's also emotional abuse that is associated with that?
Right. The assessment tools that are used within Ohio have become very holistic. And so we really have to keep in mind that, for example, a family may come to our attention because of educational neglect. Their children aren't getting to school and aren't making academic progress. So that's a certain type of neglect.
Okay.
However, we can't go into the home and only look for educational neglect. There are almost always contributing factors that require you to dig deeper. Why isn't that child getting to school? What's happening within the home that's preventing that? That's where family engagement and really understanding what's happening in that home becomes very important. So you're not just looking for educational neglect. You're looking at the why and digging deeper and deeper so that you really can work with a family to impact change, not just so that child gets to school, but so that they're successful in all arenas of their lives.
I would add also, because you brought up trauma, that that's one evolution in a child welfare field, but really in the helping field, is recognizing people's trauma and the impact it has on them. And yes, children are traumatized when they're abused. But what we've also learned in the children's services field is when we remove a child and place that child in a foster home, that child experiences additional trauma. So one of our... Yeah, they've been separated from their families. In fact, Franklin County Children's Services, they had a federal grant to screen children for traumatic experiences. And they learned from their grant that the top three most traumatic experiences a child has is being separated from their parent, if their parent is incarcerated, or the death of a parent. And if you think about the opioid epidemic, we've hit all three of those, right? And so, you know, we obviously have to address the child's trauma to make that child whole again.
Is this the case even with very young children?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you remove a child away from his mom, he's been bonding with his mom, and now placed with a complete stranger, that's very traumatic. I mean, you know, you could hear a two-year-old screaming because he does not know who's holding him at that time. That's trauma.
Mm-hmm. Katie Waddell, before we end this segment, I was just wondering if you could tell us about DeMarcus Jackson. We've been sort of talking about this all pretty academically, and you did profile the deaths of 19 children in your work. And I was wondering if we could maybe talk about him. What happened?
Yeah, sure. Sure. And just real quickly, earlier, I think you misspoke in some of the numbers. I just wanted to clarify.
Oh, sure.
The 474 are all of the deaths of children of suspected abuse or neglect. Those were not necessarily ones where there was prior abuse or contact with Children's Services. Only about half of those cases, there was some sort of prior contact. So
okay.
I just wanted to clarify
gotcha.
That.
Yep.
DeMarcus Jackson was one of the cases that got a lot of attention. Back in 2011, he had been raised since he was 8 days old by a foster family, the Thai family. I spoke with them, very nice people. I think they had actually won awards for being foster care family of the year in Hamilton County at one point. And but the family, his biological parents, went through the whole process. They did everything that they were, I guess, required to do to regain custody, and got custody back in, August of 2011 or somewhere later in the year. And it was about 2 months later that he was rushed to the hospital and unfortunately died from blunt force injuries that his father admitted to basically punching and beating him to death.
Is there anything known about how the father was trained to deal with these kinds of stresses and whether or not he followed through on that?
That I don't know. Again, Children's Services records are confidential. I was not able to get, you know, a full accounting of what that family was required to do in order to regain custody. We do know the foster parents had concerns that they brought up with caseworkers. Because on temporary visits, which were granted before permanent custody, there was a hospitalization. I believe the boy ended up in the hospital. They were concerned that he had seizure medication he was supposed to be taking. It wasn't being administered properly, things like that, and bruising. And I don't know specifically if the father was required to go to anger management or parenting classes or what is his specific situation.
Because those records are sealed.
Right.
Just before I let you go, Angela Sasser and Laura LaRoche, I mean, if you could talk a little bit about that. I get why they're sealed for privacy purposes. But is there any way that we edify ourselves, either as agencies or you know, as associations, about why it happened and What do we know? Do you pore over those files and try to understand, for instance, Lara LaRoche, what went wrong?
We do. Each county has a child fatality process that they follow that doesn't just involve child welfare, but it involves multiple systems. But I can also speak to internally, we do have a process that looks at every tragic case that may come through our system. And we look for patterns and any systemic issues potentially that could be found. There are a number of things over the years that have prompted some new initiatives or change in our process. For example, safe sleep is a pattern that we saw, and I think we see that across Ohio, that children sleeping, co-sleeping with parents, for mm-hmm. example, not on a safe sleeping service, is a real threat to newborns. And so we developed a 0-3 protocol within our agency where we assess that for all children under the age of 36 months in a more comprehensive way. Additionally, we found that, unfortunately, it's not uncommon for the alleged perpetrator in tragic cases to be a boyfriend of a parent.
So someone new to the situation.
Someone new to the situation that may not be biologically related to the child or bonded to the child. And so we began a campaign called Choose Your Partner Carefully that has been more of a community-based campaign to get the word out there that it's really important to understand who you're exposing your children to. A number of years ago, fire safety was noted to be an issue in some homes, and so we had to look at the practice of how we assess whether a home itself, the structure, through having smoke alarms in the home, is present. There were a number of child fatalities because of fire. This was about 10 years ago or so. So it is a constant process where each of these cases is reviewed in a group process throughout the organization and then also at the county level with a multi-systems approach.
Lara LaRoche, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Lara LaRoche is the intake director at the Franklin County Children's Services. Angela Saucer, executive director of the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We'll be right back and continue the conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the safety of children in the state's welfare system. A months-long investigation by the Dayton Daily News found that since 2009, more than half of the 474 children who died from suspected abuse or neglect have been known to a protection agency. Critics point to a poorly funded system that's led to overloaded and overworked caseworkers. Ohio ranks dead last in the country when it comes to state funding for their child protective services. Still with us by phone is Dayton Daily News investigative reporter Katie Waddell. And joining us by phone is the executive director of the National Coalition for Child Protection Reform and author of the book Wounded Innocence, The Real Victims of the War Against Child Abuse, Richard Wexler. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
You've written in your book that severely abused children whose cases are ignored is the result of a system diverting resources to trivial or unfounded cases. What do we mean by that? Can you compare and contrast?
One of the biggest problems is the confusion of poverty itself with neglect. For example, Ohio defines a neglected child, and this is only one small part of the definition, mm-hmm. as one, quote, whose parents, guardian, or custodian neglects the child. That's really helpful. Mm-hmm. The neglected child is a child who's neglected. But then it goes on to say, or refuses to provide proper or necessary subsistence, education, medical or surgical care or treatment, or other care necessary for the child's health, morals, or well-being. There is not an impoverished child in Ohio who couldn't be considered neglected under a definition like that at some point in her or his childhood if the child welfare agency chooses to deem it so. And nationwide, for example, 30% of America's foster children could be home right now if the parents simply had decent housing. So those cases vastly overload your system, mm-hmm. stealing time, stealing resources from finding the children in real danger.
Well, how would you change how cases are prioritized? What would you do?
Well, first of all, I would narrow down that neglect statute considerably. Mm-hmm. But secondly, I would bolster due process protections for families. You said at the very beginning of the program that there's an emphasis on protecting parental rights.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if Ohio court hearings were open, which they should be, you would see that is simply not true. Child welfare agencies can take who they want, when they want, for whatever reason they want, because there's nobody effectively fighting back. In communities which have effective defense counsel for families, the agencies are forced to stop taking so many children because of poverty, and where there really is a problem, to put the emphasis on the right kinds of help for those children. And the reason that's so important is this is a fundamental children's rights issue. Massive studies have been done comparing the outcomes in typical cases, not the horror stories, typical cases when the child is placed in foster care or the child in the same circumstances is left in his own home. Consistently, the children left in their own homes do better.
Katie Waddell, you, I guess, kind of focused on the horror stories, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, there's hundreds, thousands of sort of those typical cases. And again, because the Children's Services records aren't open, it's kind of hard to get at those. The ones that we're able to get at are, unfortunately, mm-hmm. the horror stories, because we're able to see the criminal cases play out. We're able to see, you know, records of the death and things like that. And obviously, those are stories that pull at people's heartstrings, and they want to know why these tragedies have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But also, to Katie's credit, she went beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, for example, one of the important things she found is that when you look at two of the counties which did not have a death after reunification, Montgomery County and Butler County, mm-hmm. in both cases, those were counties which reformed to take fewer children away, to emphasize safe, proven approaches to keeping families together. So they had not no horror stories, but fewer horror stories.
How are those counties operating differently, Katie Waddell? How did they do that? If it's a state run system, how do the counties break out and do it differently?
Well, it sounded to me the way that Montgomery County is doing it is they're actually opening fewer cases. They are basically working with families kind of outside of the typical court system. Instead of, you know, opening an official case and taking the child away and then making a case plan and now reunification is the goal. They're trying to hook families up with services to keep them unified without sort of setting off that clock. That's the way it sort of was explained to me, is that they're able to help families get what they need to keep their children safe, get what they need to fix whatever situation is happening without sort of setting off that official process that then they have to kind of work towards that clock.
Richard Wexler, Ohio ranks dead last in state funding. Is that reflective of reflected anywhere in all of these problems, or do you think that's just a kind of a detail that could be irrelevant if there were fewer cases taken on?
Well, the answer is both yes and no.
Yeah, okay.
Let me preface it this way. I am a tax and spend liberal and proud of it. There is nothing I would rather throw money at than child welfare, and if I lived in an Ohio county with one of those levies, I would vote for it.
Mm-hmm.
But all that said, when you look at total funding, not just the state contribution, state, local, and federal, as of 2014, which unfortunately is the most recent year available, Ohio actually spends at a rate above the national average when you compare total spending to either the number of children or the number of impoverished children. Now, that's a statewide average. It's going to vary from county to county.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that alone isn't the answer. If you just hire a bunch more caseworkers and you don't change your approach, all you get is the same lousy system, only bigger. So, yes, Ohio should spend more, but it also needs to spend smarter.
Richard Wexler, are your ideas theories, or is there some place where it's played out? I guess, for instance, Montgomery and Butler counties, right?
Not only there, but for example, a place would probably be the place you'd least expect, the state of Alabama. They were sued, a member of my group's
the
volunteer
board. The poorest state in the country, arguably.
Yeah, and yet, when they were sued and forced, and by the way, one of my group's nonprofit unpaid board members brought the lawsuit, not for, for the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law, where he is the legal director. He brought the suit. When that suit was settled, they were forced to rebuild their system to emphasize family preservation. Independent court monitors found that child safety improved. The New York Times put their reforms on the front page of the paper. The only places, and there are very few of them, that have succeeded at all are places that do more, not less, to keep families together, both because that's better for the children who are spared needless removal and because it frees up time for workers to find those children in real danger.
Who shouldn't be returned.
Exactly. There are some children who should not.
What about these, what appear to be sort of artificial deadlines, 12 months after intake, the kid, they should be shooting for reunification. What about those kinds of things?
The deadlines are awful for some of the reasons discussed on your program, but also because what happens is states then rush to terminate parental rights, whether there's any place for the child or not, and you create what are called legal orphans, children who bounce from home to home, emerge years later unable to love or trust anyone, and become young adults with no ties to their own families and no adoptive home either. It's likely that since we started imposing these timelines at the federal level, that's created 100,000 more of these legal orphans than we would have had without them. And I have to tell you, one of those most responsible for those deadlines and for making that big mistake was Mike DeWine.
How so?
When he was a senator, he strongly pushed the federal legislation that imposed that and a number of other onerous provisions which enshrined a take-the-child-and-run mentality in American child welfare.
Tell me about why, what you know about in other states, if it's the case, as it is, has been in Ohio, why lawmakers are so reluctant to do an overhaul of the system.
Well, it's not always that they're reluctant to do an overhaul. It's often that they do the wrong things.
Okay.
Understandably, you read about the horror story cases, and many journalists don't do as well as Katie Waddell. They don't look at all the nuances and context. You only hear about the horror stories. So, of course, you think the system must be bending over backwards to reunify families. So you get a foster care panic. Every worker is afraid of having the next such case on her caseload. So the number increases. Legislators run around trying to look how tough they are and look at how, oh, we're going to crack down on child abuse. So they pass laws that tend to make things worse. So it's not that they won't reform. It's that the real reforms, the kind of things that Alabama has done and things like that, require a lot of political courage.
Katie Waddell, in pursuing this investigation, how did you determine to go deeper than just the horror stories? What triggered that for you as a journalist?
Well, I mean, it's just such a complex system, and every sort of direction I went in, looking at, okay, well, there's kids that are dying because they're being put back with their parents. Well, we also have kids that die in foster care.
Uh-huh.
And so it's like, it sort of started to, my head spins a little bit trying to think, well, wait, which direction do you go to fix this? And Richard was very helpful when I spoke with him. He reached out and pointed me to some studies, you know, that showed some of these nuances were actually some of the deeper issues and what other states had done. And it started to kind of become, well, we can't just focus on one piece of this. We have to tell the whole story.
Katie Waddell, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Katie Waddell, data journalist investigating government waste, fraud, and abuse, is a member of the I-Team for the Dayton Daily News. Also, Richard Wexler, executive director of the National Coalition for the Child Protection Reform and author of the book Wounded Innocents, The Real Victims of the War Against Child Abuse. Thanks, Richard, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.